I say, let's say figuratively, right? A good day in the office. Everybody's on form. They wake up one day and they have a good day where they're motivated, they're buzzing, they're on it, they're constructive. But not many people can sustain that. And that's the difference, yeah? It's, for me to do what I do is not a chore. Some people, it's really painful for them. Dude, this is just wired into my head. So, like, I have to stop myself from working and thinking and strategizing and take time away, you know, as opposed to thinking, oh, I need to do this, I need to be here, I need to work out this deal, I got to work on that. That's not like that for me. It's just all that water. Do you see what I mean? So I have an advantage at the fact that I'm not working at trying to be consistent. It's just absolutely natural. And I think that's just the only difference. I'm made of flesh, blood. I'm not Einstein. My IQ is not crazy. I'm a bit sharp, yeah. I have great instincts, but I'm just like anybody else. But the consistency is the only difference that separates me.
My graduates from my school being Forbes, backdrop.
Backdrop.
A mic drop. Backdrop.
Backdrop.
All right, guys, welcome back. EYL UK edition. This is going to be a very, very special, legendary episode. I got a feeling.
Yeah.
Anton Dixon Bellot.
You got
say it.
It
correctly?
Yeah, man.
Got it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I got introduced. First of all, shout out to Ashley, who actually made the introduction on Instagram. And shout out to everybody in the UK, because there's been a lot of that. Like, everybody that we've really been meeting have been people that either we just met or we didn't even know. And they'd like make an introduction. They've been very hospitable and very welcoming. So thank
our
you.
Our relationships, man.
It's all about more
than money.
For sure. So when she DM'd me, she was telling me, she's like, look, you got to interview this guy. Like, he's like our Tyler Perry here in the UK. And so once I did the research and I saw the Forbes articles, and it's very similar.
Yeah.
Very similar. So a very interesting story, really started from the bottom.
Now you're here.
18 years ago, I think, right? 18 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he started doing music videos, very, you know, low budget production music video. Now he's scaled it to not only an 8-figure real estate portfolio, mm-hmm. but a media empire, mm-hmm. where he controls the whole supply chain. So the Tyler Perry comparison is actually very fitting.
Yeah.
So we'll get into it. But he literally controls the whole thing. He owns it. So he actually just bought an estate for, I believe, £4 million.
Yeah.
On the countryside of England, where it's going to be, you can shoot content.
Yeah, studio with lots. Something that we've seen.
A lake,
in Atlanta.
I believe, a lake.
Don't forget the lake.
Lots, huge estate,
mm-hmm.
52 acres.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
So this is going to be one of the ones, yeah. man. So first and foremost, thank
wait, we forgot one business. We can't forget the multi-million-dollar lens production company.
Well, I was going to go through all of the businesses.
Yeah, that's major.
That's all part of the supply chain.
Yeah, yeah. The value chain, they said.
Value chain.
Value chain.
I like that.
I like that.
Well, first and foremost, thank you for joining us. Appreciate it.
Pleasure, guys. Thank you for having me here, man.
Yeah.
Hold on. Trust me.
I said we're going to need horns. Anytime legends walk in, we need horns playing. So we should have had some horns playing when you walk
in. Your presence is enough, man. Presence enough.
Trumpets. So let's do this. I want to go through everything, but let's talk about your journey from starting doing music videos to progression. Like, how did you actually get into even thinking about film production, filming, all of that stuff?
You know what? That's a part of my past that I don't talk about too much, because it's kind of so irrelevant now, but was so relevant then.
Mm-hmm.
But back in the day, I was part of a grime, you know grime, right?
Yeah.
That's like before drill music,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, well before. That's like just after like garage, house and garage, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was part of a grime group where a guy and myself, who now actually, funny enough, has gone down the same route in music videos, we started a grime group and we made our own beats, and we were the music producers. Some would spit in it as well with rap. And then this platform came about, which was called Channel U, which was the first television channel that played unsigned, like low budget music videos. So for the first time, you had more than MTV bass, you know, whatever else. So they obviously made the barrier to entry a lot lower to allow people like myself, like amateur filmmakers or aspiring amateur filmmakers, to come in and try and basically try a thing, bring, like make a video, get it submitted, and see if they can get it broadcast. Mm-hmm. So we just spoke about making our own video, and we made one from our own group, which was only supposed to be for us to make our own content. And I remember getting a phone call from one of the channel managers and saying, she's like, "Hey Antoine, quick question. How much did your music video cost and who made it for you? Because I've got a lot of people that are using your video as a reference that they want to have their video made." I was like, "Gosh, we made the video." And she was like, "Oh, okay. How much do you charge?" Because she's thinking that we do this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're just rappers, you know? And I'm like, I don't know. Off the top of my head, I'm like, £5? Like £500, okay, right? Yeah, yeah. And she's like, okay. And then she put us in touch. And obviously, at that time, everything was for free. We're shooting on a camcorder. Remember, like the old DV tapes?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We're shooting on a camcorder. We're just shooting anywhere, anyhow. This is like runandgun.com, right? So anyway, we got linked up with other artists. We're shooting. The budgets went from 500 to 1,000 to 3,000 to 5,000. And the rest is basically history, you know? So it was an accident.
Yeah.
It was an accident. It was because of music.
Mm. So you were an artist that just, you know, we're going to do it ourselves and ended up creating a business.
Exactly.
I think during that process, one of the brilliant things I heard is that when you started making the videos, you didn't try to find the top people in the space. You found college students to hire.
Yeah, yeah.
Which makes perfect sense because those are the people, university here, but those are the people who actually are studying, but they don't have any money.
That's right.
And so that they can hone their talents mm-hmm. while getting paid at a low rate for you.
Of course.
But they can grow with you too.
Absolutely.
You like went into it with that vision? Like, you know what? I'm going that route because you were studying film.
It was circumstantial. So obviously I was like, how can I create this infrastructure? Because remember at the time, I'm not really in the film industry, so I don't know people, you know? And even if you knocked at the doors in those days, there wasn't many of us around. The doors were mostly closed. You know, you'd have to send an email or pigeon or in those days, like, to try and get on set. And if you were lucky enough to get on set, you're taking that rubbish, you know, mm-hmm. like the trash, right?
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
So
yeah, we know rubbish.
Translate. So like, it was a way for me to kind of think off the cuff, you know? And I was like, cool. We're training to do this. People are half competent. I can give them a platform and experience. I get my own experience, and it was just a match made in heaven. So I was basically using university classmates as my film crew. You know, it worked.
So what point do you scale from the music videos to like producing in the film world?
Well, in terms of making movies, I've only just started making films. Mm. So music videos just grew from strength to strength at the time.
Yeah.
We did the odd TV commercial, but music videos was just my forte. We were just known for making music videos, and you know, up until last year, we shoot the biggest artists in the country.
So it went from the music videos, and correct me if I'm wrong, after that it was, okay, rather than going on places and locations, let me find a studio. So at that point, you're looking for places to rent, or you're saying like, okay, you know what, this is costing me too much to go on location, get permits and all that. Let me find a space where we can actually shoot content.
Well, that's fast forward in 10 years, yeah? So before that, I managed to buy my own camera, part of my own camera, because if you remember the Red One, if you guys know, the Red One camera was revolutionary at the time. When it came out, it was like magic, right? And it was the first time that we could shoot as close to 35mm film as possible. So I managed to buy the camera body, which I remember in pounds was like 17,000, just the body.
Ooh.
Yeah. Then you had the rest of the modular equipment. So we're talking about a tasty amount of money, you know, to create your whole filming package. So I was able to buy a bit at a time. So I was using profits from my music videos to buy asset after asset, modular after modular, and assemble the kit. And the more kit I can buy, the less I have to cross hire. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So then eventually you retain your profit.
Mm,
so then once you've bought your equipment, your profit becomes profit and doesn't just get reinvested into the assets.
Yeah.
Are you with me?
Let's get into that because the supply chain. So, all right. So you have East London Studios. That's your studio.
Yes. That was founded in 2014.
Okay. Then you have Chine House. That's the camera company, right?
Cine House. That's camera and lighting rental company.
Mm-hmm.
And then Cine's Corpse Optics.
CityScope Optics.
So
that's the lens,
that's
manufacturing,
the lens manufacturing business, right? Yeah. And then Mastermind Media.
That's the production company.
That's the production company. ADP Films Services.
So ADP Film Services is the company that's the limited company that Cinehouse and East London Studios trade under. So Cinehouse and East London Studios are the trading names, but they're owned by the holding company of ADB Film Services.
Mm. So let's go through each one. Can we go through in a time order?
Timeline,
like,
sure.
Which one started first?
Mastermind.
Okay.
So it was making content. And it was seeing these lines, we call them lines in a budget, we call them lines, right? When you break down itemized costs. So going through these lines after a few years, I'm like, okay, I'm spending this much on camera, this much on lights, this much on crew, this much on location, whether it be exterior permits, whether it be interior locations or film studio. Mm-hmm. So then you start to realize, you're looking at your numbers and you're breaking down your costs. I'm like, okay, this year I've spent 70,000, 80,000 in camera, 100 grand in lighting, 60,000 in locations. So then you just start thinking, if I own that and that, every year this becomes X. I mean, it's not rocket science,
right, you know?
And every producer at the time must see what I'm seeing, because we're all looking at our budgets retrospectively, thinking, look at this money that's being spent.
Yeah.
So for me, since 2009 is when I bought, 2010 is when I bought my Red One, you know, and automatically I'm now saving money on the hire. But then what I didn't really expect, I did it so I could just save more money and make more money. I'm getting other filmmakers coming to me to hire my equipment. And that's where you, just like the accident of becoming a filmmaker, is now I'm accidentally becoming a facility provider.
Yeah.
Because I was just trying to buy kit for me so I could retain profit.
Yeah, so you had the asset. The camera was the asset,
yes,
that you were trying to obtain. You took the profits from the music video to keep upgrading the asset.
Correct.
And because of the content you're producing with the asset, people said, can we rent from you?
Yep, which brings in more money.
Now you got more money.
Right?
So that leads to the next company, which
was East London Studios.
East London Studios.
Because I realized trying to push Mastermind Media forward, owning these facilities would create good leverage, and be very palatable for record labels, knowing that they could come and get, you know, what we call, you know, like a one-stop shop, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when budgets are tight, because back then, again, budgets are, you know, if, for an up-and-coming artist, they'll give you 5 to 10. And if you're a known artist, it could be 20. So it's tight, super tight. So I'm thinking, how can I still put in high production value, but not have to get torn apart by the suppliers who are going to charge me crazy money for equipment, you know? So it was a way, it was kind of like a two-prong attack. Just create another business and increase the production value for Mastermind Media.
And then, okay. So then the East London Studios, then what comes after that?
So after East London Studios came Cinehouse.
It's pronounced Cinehouse?
Cinehouse, yeah.
Cinehouse.
Okay. So, because again, East London Studios is just a commercial film location, big stage,
like,
right?
A warehouse where
Exactly, okay. Yeah. Like, you know, but, you know, fully converted with rigs, pre-light setups, you know, the white cove, a blackout studio, all your green rooms up on a mezzanine. It was kitted out of a film studio. But again, just like I analysed as a producer, I'm now a film studio owner. I'm seeing all the productions in the country, because we were a household studio.
Mm-hmm.
So all the big production companies are coming in, and I'm seeing what lights they're bringing in. I'm seeing what cameras they're bringing in. I know what their spends are. So now I'm like, okay, I want to own that. Because you have, as when you get a budget, you have to spend, I'm going to give you just indicative numbers, yeah? Mm-hmm. You have to spend £2,000 a day on camera. You have to spend £3,000 a day on lights. And every day or every other day, these production companies are coming in and they're getting it from all the other commercial suppliers. And I'm like, nah.
Got it.
You know what's happening here.
Yeah.
So I, just like with the production company, I'm like, if I own the rental house, not only do you pay me for the production, for the film studio, you now pay me for equipment. Yeah. Plus I realized that just selling space wasn't going to make me millions, because you can only charge a certain amount of money per day for a film stage. But if you now have a camera and lighting list to add to the film studio, now my costs, my expansion is triple. It's a triple threat then. And if somebody has a big job, or they have a 3 or 4 day shoot, I'm making not just 3 days studio, I'm making 3 days studio, 3 days camera, 3 days lights. Now the numbers are looking a bit more interesting.
Mm.
Mm. You know?
So the process of getting the studio itself, was that funded by the profits from the music videos and the rentals together? How did you come to that?
Profit from music videos. So by this time, I was flying. I was doing really well in production-wise, mm-hmm. relatively speaking, yeah? Not Hollywood levels, but relatively speaking.
Yeah.
It was enough to put a deposit down on a lease. I had a couple of partners at the time. It was a couple of us.
Mm.
One was a quite well-known DOP, black DOP. And another guy was a guy that was kind of coming out of his career, an older white guy coming out of his career, lovely dude, who was had a rental house and he was in filmmaking. So we collaborated on the cost and ran the business. I ran the business.
Sounds more like it.
Yeah. But you know, we came together on the studio. I think the biggest conflict that we had retrospectively is the fact that I saw the expansion and I wanted to combine the rental house into the studio, but they were quite focused on just the studio and not really wanting to invest or see the vision for having a rental house. And that's, things became a bit conflicted.
Yes.
And I subsequently bought them out one by one and restructured the business, rebranded Cine House. And then, you know, in that respect, the rest is complete history.
Yeah. I mean, we haven't talked about that yet. When you have partners come together and somebody gets bought out, obviously, you know, you talk positively about them. How was that process, though, when you saw the vision, but you know they lacked it?
It was awkward, for more of a better word. It was awkward because when you're, you know, your friends, peers at the time, and now your business partners, you know, so it becomes very difficult to, when you feel passionately about something and knowing that you really want to implement a change and people are not aligned with you, it becomes very, very difficult because you want to try to preserve the business relationship and the friendship, you know? Well, you should do at least. and that was the most challenging thing. The purchase acquisition of the partners wasn't entirely smooth, but it was for the best. I'm sure we're all agreed now, you know, it's for the best. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure, had we stayed as partners, that the business would have become what it is today. Creative differences.
Lens. So when did this lens manufacturing business come into play?
That came in, again, not so much an accident, but more opportunistic. So I used to, as a hobby, rehouse, obviously, because I'm in the film industry, so I understand equipment. I used to rehouse old stills lenses. So rehousing is a term used to...
like refurbish?
Well, not quite. Kind of remanufacture.
Okay.
So imagine a stills lens is like, you know, old vintage still lenses are old. They have different, you know, barrels. They just look completely different, but the glass is the only thing that you keep.
Mm-hmm.
The actual optics, right? So they strip it down completely and rebuild a whole new lens. So the new, you know, when you see new film lenses now, that's what a new lens looks like. But back in the day, it was just old and vintage, mm-hmm. and it was not compatible to put onto new cameras. It's a major, major process.
Yeah.
It's rebuilt from scratch, almost. So I was rehousing. I bought a set for myself, again, to add to my value chain, to add to my production equipment base, and had people saying to me, "Ant, these lenses are sick. Would you get them from? Can I buy some?" And at the time, there's a 2-year waiting list, right?
Everyone has an opinion when it comes to the foods we eat. This food's good for you. This one's bad for you. This diet works best. But who actually has the right answer? You don't need rules to lose weight. You just need proper information to build smarter, more sustainable habits. Noom is here to change the way we view food by not only looking at what we eat, but also how we eat. Instead of making you feel guilt, Noom empowers you to keep going. Not everyone wants to be on a strict diet, do 5 days a week at the gym, or have daily smoothies and questionable teas. Noom uses a psychology-based approach to find healthier balance that's more suitable for your life and, as a result, more sustainable. Look, Noom has already influenced the way I shop for food, which has not only saved me money, it's also given me a clearer understanding of the foods I'm consuming, which has made me sharper and more energetic. You have to try it out. Look, there are no food restrictions in the program, which makes the process more flexible for your lifestyle. Everybody's journey is different. Noom believes in progress, not perfection. 75% of Noom users finish the program, and more than 60% of users engaged with the program keep the weight off for a year or even more. With Noom, all you need is a daily 10-minute check-in. No grueling early mornings or huge chunks out of your day. Are you ready to start building better habits for healthier, long-term results? Sign up for a Noom trial at Noom.com/leisure. That's Noom.com/leisure. Don't wait. Don't hesitate. Head over there now.
So, and I used the best rehousing company in the world at the time, notably the best rehousing company in the world, who were based in Leicester over here in England. And I ended up selling the set that I kept for myself because I doubled up. So I think I purchased the set. Purchasing the actual lens glass and remanufacturing cost me 25,000. I resold it for like 47, 48, 50 pounds, right? And I'm like, hey, that's a lot of dough. Okay. So then I did a bit of research, realized what people were shooting with, went, spoke to some rental companies, and they said, you know, we all like this particular lens. And I went and stockpiled at the time 5, 6, 7 sets of lenses. So I went onto eBay, I went onto private dealers. I scoured the internet to get all this glass and hoard it, put in a back order because it was a 2-year waiting list. So I ordered them one by one sequentially. I pre-sold every set of lenses. And I think at the end, I think a few years down the line, I think I turned over about £1 million. Right. Just, and that, this is just as a hobby. It's just for banter.
Yeah.
Literally in the background. And then I was like, oh, okay, cool. And I left it for a bit because the glass became expired because vintage lenses, the glass runs out because it's not made anymore. And that was basically that. And then when I revisited another lens that was more available, I sat down with the manufacturers, the rehousing specialists, and said, guys, I think I want to do this for real now. And they were like, if I can do that as a hobby and make £1 million, what happens if I do it seriously? So everybody was all ears. They called a big meeting, big round table, all the corporates, all of the private equity guys. And I sat them down. I gave them my idea and said, I need you to be my exclusive manufacturer. And here we are. And that was the major turning point for me, because that capital enabled me to make serious moves.
So they made an investment in you?
No. Okay. The investment was them giving me an exclusivity arrangement where they can only manufacture these lenses for me and my company. That was the deal.
How long was the process?
They had to X everybody out in the world.
Wow. How long was the process of actually making the lens?
It can take about 3 weeks to make a set of lenses, maybe a week to make one lens. They have to strip it down. They have all these elements that have to be custom made, built back, measure the focus, engrave the lenses. It's a big process. And it's very, very costly.
So you got the whole thing. So you have the production studio. Then you actually have the camera company. You have the lens company. This is all happening step by step. And you're just realizing, but before you know it, you created your own ecosystem.
Yes.
All self-funded.
Yes, correct.
So the idea is the all money in strategy where you take profit and just reinvest it.
Correct.
Did you ever take any outside funding?
No. Not at the time. Like now, you finance rental equipment with what I think called asset finance. So you asset finance all of your lenses, because when you're spending $140,000 on a set of lenses, like for example, Cinehouse owns a set of Cook anamorphic lenses that cost £140,000. Like, you're not spending that out of cash because it doesn't make sense. Like, now where I've become more financially literate, I understand about leverage.
So talk about that, the asset financing. What's that?
So when you get to a certain point and your accounts are sustainable, you use finance companies to buy equipment and then you pay it like a mortgage.
Okay.
Like, it's a lot shorter term. It's like 3 to 5 years.
Okay.
Like, you need big, healthy accounts in order to justify the spend and the recuperability.
So it's a loan.
That's years later.
It's a loan to buy assets for your business.
Exactly.
Are the interest rates higher because the term is so short, or how's that?
Not the interest rates exactly. The payments are expensive because you're consolidating your repayment, your capital repayment.
Yeah.
So with a mortgage, for example, you have, let's say even, let's give a like example, £140,000 apartment to £140,000 set of lenses. Well, your apartment would be over a 25 or 30 year mortgage term,
right,
whereas your lenses would be over 4 to 5 years. So you consolidate your repayment, which makes your payments monthly so much more expensive, yes, which means that your viability financially, proof has to be a lot higher to be able to prove affordability. So it's quite complicated. It's not straightforward.
Yeah, it makes sense. 140,000. So what type of clients are rented? Are these like big movie houses? Like who's the client profile that's taking that type of investment?
For asset finance?
Well, for those type of lenses, right? You said 140,000.
Our clients would be any production companies that are you know, shooting serious productions.
So Ozark was a client, right?
Ozark was a client, or the production team from Ozark bought a set of my CineScope lenses. So that's not through CineHouse. They actually bought a set. They liked the look of that particular lens and the rebuild quality of that particular brand, which was my brand. And I got contacted by the DOP. It said, look, we've got season 3 starting in like 6 weeks. I need you just to fast track me a set. And I'm like, hey, I watched that show. Let's make it happen.
Shout out to Marty.
Yeah, man. Yeah, shout out to Marty.
So at one point, all right, so this is all amazing, by the way. So what point do you, so another play is the real estate play. Mm-hmm. You've actually become a very, you know, healthy real estate owner in England. So where does this tie in? As far as you're doing all this and you're getting all these businesses, at what point do you say, okay, now it's not actually just a business play, it's a real estate play as well?
Sure. Well, funny enough, I was quite inspired. I've not told this story, right? I was quite inspired by real estate as a almost like a fallback. Obviously, we all have passive income. We all have appreciating assets, of course. But CineScope, for me, was almost too good to be true. I'm like, I've never made so much money so easily in my whole legal, you know? So I'm like, this is crazy. But because I understand that we're rehousing vintage glass, like I said, vintage glass will run out. When vintage glass runs out, I have no product. So I'm sitting there thinking, right, I've got about 5 to 7 years to maybe turn over 10 million or something, whatever, right? Cool. But what happens when it stops? So I'm like, okay, everything else is running and businesses are doing well, but I'm just thinking of an exit. So every single profit that was made from CineScope, and I mean, I didn't even buy a toothbrush, bro. Like every single piece of profit from that particular business purchased real estate. That was the absolute plan because I wanted to compound the profits. So obviously, as you know about appreciation, capital appreciation, I'm like, if I'm going to put in 5 million of my own money in 10 years on 2%, that's going to be X. Do you see what I mean? So I'm sitting there thinking, so one day CineScope's going to stop because I'm going to run out of glass. I need to be good. I mean, good. Mm-hmm. So that was basically the reason why I entered the property market so aggressively, because it was aggressive. I went from a £300,000 portfolio to 15 million in 4.5 years.
Wow.
You know?
What type of properties were you looking at initially?
Just what I could afford. So it was just like one bedroom apartments or like a normal small 3-bedroom terrace house. Just, you know, family properties. It was just entry level, you know, because that's all I could afford at the time. And then I started understanding the advantages of buying blocks of flats, you know, and from a maintenance standpoint, from a just a being practical, rather than having properties dotted all around the country, I've got a block of 12 and a block of 10. Now it makes the workflow and the infrastructure a lot more simple to maintain. So then I started buying blocks of flats.
So blocks, for anybody in America that doesn't know, a flat is an apartment. And so you're buying like the whole block.
Correct.
And are you looking at areas specific? Like, are you looking at areas that's about to get gentrified, areas in the hood? Like, what's your strategy where it's like, all right, this is a place where I want to invest in?
It was high yielding areas. So I have different strategies. So for example, if I'm buying an already made block, I'm going to buy it probably out of London, not too far. We're talking like 45 minutes to an hour out of London because the yields are higher.
In the suburbs. Like.
So the appreciation is less, but the yield is higher, right? That's the rental return. Whereas in London, you have a lower yield and a higher appreciation in value. So you have to work it out like this. You know, one of the latest things I've done, I've just done a four-story Victorian house conversion into a block of apartments in London, in Greenwich actually. But I've done that to build. I would never try to buy it because the value has been taken already. If I purchase a ready-made block, in like a conversion block, I am the exit for the developer. Are you with me? Mm-hmm. So I would do that myself. So I was buying houses with planning permission, converting them into apartments, remortgaging them. All the money comes back. We go again.
Did you take that same approach that you did with, obviously, the production team, where it was like, all right, I see the cameras. I know how much it costs to rent that. And flip it into your real estate portfolio, where it was like, well, this is how much it costs for construction. I need to become the construction team. Did you take that approach too?
Accidentally.
You did. Yeah. a lot of accidents happen.
You know, although I don't have an official construction team, yeah. I've got about five multi-traders. So multi-traders means guys that can do plumbing, carpentry, electrics, plastering, yeah? So I've got five guys on the books through my property company, ADB Investment, because obviously when you do day work and you plan it properly, you can save 40% if you were to do price work. So price work is builders come in, scratch their head, and they tell you a price for what the job's going to be. But believe me, there's lots of markup in that. Profit, yeah? So yeah. It could be 30, 40, 50%. But if I'm controlling the contractors or the subcontractors, then all that profit goes back to me because I'm only paying the day rate. But I have to know what I'm doing. So I had to become very savvy very quickly so I could direct these builders to get them to do the work that needed to be done. Are you with me?
Yeah.
So, yeah. It's
so when you talk about remortgaging, that's kind of like what we call in the States refinancing.
Correct.
So you buy, it's very similar. In, like you buy a home, you're buying it through the mortgage.
Yep. Sometimes.
Or sometimes you buy cash.
Sometimes, yeah.
All right. So you get a home mortgage. Any special type of mortgage, or you just do traditional mortgage?
I do traditional mortgages, which is a residential mortgage or a buy-to-let mortgage.
A buy-to-what?
Buy-to-let.
What's that?
So if you're buying it to rent out, you have to declare that, which mm-hmm. means you pay a higher interest rate, and you also have to pay a higher deposit.
Like investment property.
If it's an investment property. Yeah,
precisely. Right. So over here, investment properties start at a 25% deposit.
Down payment.
Yeah, similar.
And a higher interest rate. Yeah.
What's the interest rate?
It varies. It can vary from 2% to 3.5% if you go for traditional mortgages.
Right.
That's without bridging and other stuff, which is another ball game. But in terms of that, you're looking at around 2 to 3.5% for an investment property.
Is it the same 15, 30 year? In terms of length of the mortgage?
Yeah. You can ask for whatever term you want, up to 30 years, depending on your age,
okay.
basically. But again, it doesn't really make a difference on an interest-only mortgage because you're only going to pay the interest anyway, which means you'd have to have another exit when you expire your mortgage. Whereas with a repayment mortgage, capital repayment, you are bringing the debt down. So at the end of that term, you will own it outright if you don't refinance.
So your strategy is find blocks of flat in suburban areas outside the city, purchase it, do some rehabbing, and then refinance mm-hmm. once the property has appreciated, because once you do the rehabs, then it's going to go up in value.
Yep.
You refinance, take that money out, and then rinse and repeat, and then buy some more real estate.
That's one strategy. There's around four, but that's one strategy. Another strategy is renewing leases. So when you buy an apartment block with low lease, the property is really, really devalued because you have to have over here, I think it's above 70 something years, 72, I don't know, 70 odd years needs to be a lease on the apartment in order for it to be mortgageable. If it's under that amount of time, a certain number, you have to buy it in cash, which means you it's devalued. So what I would do is I'll go and buy a flat in cash, go and speak to the freeholder, extended lease on it. A standard lease here is 99 years or be 125, but 99 years is standard for 99 year lease. Yeah. That's if you buy a leasehold property, not a freehold property.
Right? 99 years.
Yes.
Oh, explain it. What's a leasehold versus
a leasehold is basically you have a license to own that house for a certain amount of time. So every apartment will be a leasehold. You cannot buy a freehold unless you own the freehold of the block of the building.
Okay. So freehold is when you own it free and clear.
Well, you own the land. You own the land and the entire dwelling. You don't just own that area, the apartment. Are you with me? You can't buy a freehold if you are buying an apartment unless you have a share of freehold, which is, I don't see the point. because you can't do what you want.
Like so, a co-op.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, like
co-op.
Share yes. sales, like a, co-op, a collective of people.
Yes, yes.
So, okay. So
but it's not worth much.
So because you can't just buy a flat. You have to buy the whole entire land, building, everything.
Who me? You mean
no,
me?
No, just person? In general.
If it's, you can buy a leasehold flat. People don't sell the freeholds because, for example, the reason why is that if you've got a block of, say, 30 apartments, everybody's purchased an apartment, which means that you only sell off that area. So so when you have an apartment block, you have what's called a title, right? So everybody has their own title for each apartment, which means you buy that title, so you buy that apartment block. And that just means that that's your property. You have to pay service charge to the freeholder. So who's going to clean the communal areas? Who's going to sort out the rubbish area outside and all these things, maintenance? So the freeholder takes care of that because a person that owns an apartment can't take care of all of the areas that service that block,
right.
Which is the reason why you only have a leasehold.
Okay. This sounds like co-ops, pretty much.
Yeah. So 99 years.
99 years. So if a property is under 70 years, you can't get a mortgage on it at all. You have to buy it in cash, or it might be 67 years. I'm not too sure, but you have to buy it in cash, or you have to get renew the lease. Renewing the lease could cost you £25,000. To renew the lease, back up to 99 years, then you can get a mortgage on it. But then the value increases crazy, right? So I will buy an apartment with a low lease. I'll go on an auction, it says low lease apartment. So if something's worth, I'll give an example, right? I bought a flat. This was my first low lease purchase quite a few years ago. So the value of it was 140,000. It was a one bedroom flat in Kent, 140,000. I purchased it for 67,000. On an auction because it was run down. So that brings the value down already. Run down meaning it was like distressed, And the lease was like 50 years. So I've spent £10,000 on a renovation. I have spent £22,000 on a 99 year lease extension. So now I'm in for like 85,000 or so. And then I remortgaged a 75% loan to value on 140,000. Right?
Gotcha.
So then I got back every single penny, got paid on top, still had 25% equity in the property, and now I have a cash flow and asset. Basically, it's a free flat, and I'm paid to take it.
So when you extend...
Do you see the play?
Yeah, for sure.
When you extended the lease, obviously you said it was a low lease, so it was 50 years. Are you extending it just so it gets to the 99? Are you like, I'm going to extend it for 49 years?
You have your solicitor lets you know what the cost will be, but I believe the closer it is to 99 years, the cheaper it is, basically.
Yeah.
But you need to get above that threshold so you can mortgage it. So I could not get a mortgage until I was above that threshold.
Gotcha.
Right? And you speak to, before you purchase, I advise people, speak to the freeholder first, work out your numbers, make sure you can get through to the freeholder. Because if you buy a property and you can't get through to the freeholder, how can you increase the lease? Then you have to go to court and there's a mandatory process that gets your lease extended automatically, but that takes some time.
Yeah.
So for anyone out there that's trying to copy that particular strategy that I explained, make sure you speak to your freeholder and work and make sure they're contactable to negotiate your lease before purchase. Then you've got your exit quicker.
Whole lot of gain.
That's a lot of gain.
What's the other one, as you said?
Just buying down distressed properties. Like, for example, the £4 million country estate I bought that was like Black Friday. Like,
when I saw the acres, I don't know exactly where it is, but I know obviously, you know, the UK real estate is expensive.
Yes.
So I'm like, £4 million, that seemed like it could be kind of cheap.
It was, yeah, the main mansion was very distressed, very outdated. And it's currently undergoing a £2 million renovation. An extension, I'm adding an east and west wing to it. I'm adding rooftop terraces. So when you come out the bedrooms, the French doors go out onto rooftop terraces. The main swimming pool building is now being connected to the main house. I'm refurbing all the 14 outbuildings, adding a second private road, adding serious infrastructure, you know, and I'll probably get an £8 million valuation once I'm finished.
And so what's
that's going to be all done within a year.
In a year?
I'm 9 months in.
And the play with that is to have that as kind of like your headquarters for content?
Correct. So it'll be a hospitality venue. Event space, yeah. So events, hospitality, galas, you know.
Mm.
It will be an HQ for me. But also because of the vast space, it will be, I want to do it, be like a filming village.
Yeah.
So on some of the fields and a lot of the acres at the back, I want to be building some big stages.
Yeah.
So you can actually do like East London Studios times 20, you know, all the big massive stages. You've got backlot for days. You know, you can shoot Saving Private Ryan to, you know, Game of Thrones, you know, with the fields.
So on the 52 acres, we're talking about like lots similar, like we said with Tyler Perry, where he has the studios and there's a bunch of lots and they can shoot shows on it. Mm-hmm. But not only can you shoot your own shows, but production companies can come in and rent the space.
This
now.
Will be a commercial. Again. This will be a commercial location for sure.
Right. So like companies like Viacom could say, all right, we want to shoot the show on lot number 12.
We want to be there for 2 years or whatever, you know, or you have like a period drama, TV period drama that wants that. It's a Georgian mansion. So it's very like palace-y, you know, and they might say, right, we want to shoot a season of, I don't know, Bridgerton or something, which, you know, for the next 12 months. Cool. Take that then, you know?
Yeah.
So it will be that. But obviously there's a lot of red tape in these areas. So it's a stage by stage process. For now, it's renovate the property, the main property, because that's what I do as a developer.
Yeah.
I'll get probably every penny back. Yeah. And it'll be an in and out for me. And then I'll put the rest of the money into making the rest of the infrastructure around the lands. But we're shooting there already. So it's, things are happening.
When you say you get every penny out on a refi?
Absolutely.
What do you call a refi again?
Remortgage.
Remortgage.
That same thing. Okay. Exactly the same thing.
When you said that, obviously, of course, you fall by the time you finish renovating, it's going to be an $8 million valuation. Is that with the lots already built? Or
No.
Because like when the lots get built,
that's another thing.
We're talking maybe 30, 40.
Yeah. We're just talking about what's there.
Right now.
Yeah, right now.
What's that like? What's the cost to build an actual lot? Like we see them, we travel to L.A., bunch of times, and we see the size, the massive like amount of production that goes into just one lot.
Mm-hmm.
How much would it like on average? You think that's going to cost to probably put like 8 lots?
It's millions. It's telephone numbers for sure. Yeah, <it's>,
like that.
You know, telephone numbers.
That's a fact. All right. Now you have this vision. What's the plan to actually implement? Because I'm assuming it's going to, like, a lot of staff. You got to have, like, security. You got to have, like, it's a whole operation for
absolutely.
This. So you have that plan in place yet already?
Semi. Okay. So as I said, it's in stages because right now there's a huge mortgage on this estate and the maintenance costs. I mean, little things you don't think about. Mm-hmm. Because it's so green, it's in the country. My gardening costs, man, are, like, for gardeners, yeah? It's unprecedented. It's thousands and thousands of pounds a month just for my gardeners. Mm. And there's no value in that. I'm just keeping the place from overgrowing. You know, my tree surgeon cutting down trees, branches, bro, it's just mad.
That's like we interviewed.
So it's a write-off. The money is gone. So it's like get this place up and running quick, get that money back, get some primary projects in there. Then while that's happening, I can be somewhere else in some other acres building the lots.
Yeah.
You know, and that stuff can be running over there, so it doesn't interfere.
You said those things are write-offs, because obviously, it's not your primary residence.
No,
it's a studio.
So it's just a studio, but I mean, he has the mansion part of it.
Yeah.
So all these things, the gardening, they're going to be write-offs on from the property.
Yeah, of course. But when I say write-off, there's two write-offs. There's tax write-off, but I mean write-off as in the money is not an investment. It's not recoupable.
Okay,
is what I mean as a running cost.
Okay.
But of course, that will also be written off in that sense.
Yeah,
exactly.
So what made you pick that? How far is the town from like here? Like
from that area, it's about an hour and 20 minutes, an hour and 25 minutes. It's not crazy.
So what made you, just see something online where it's like, oh, that's a cheap property. Let me just get it.
Yeah, because I'm always looking for where I can add value and recoup, you know, to re-exit the money. And that was an opportunity. But at the same time, I had my eye on an expansion. I mean, I'm like, okay, I'm doing well, but how do I do better in terms of the film industry? And this is an opportunity, you know, for me to go into also my next venture, which is actually finally making feature films, you know, finally. I had my eye slightly from a property hat on and also a film industry hat, and they just married perfectly for this particular acquisition.
So you're going into the movie industry. How has it been? Like, have you made relationships with like people in the music, in the movie business here in London? Is it like a old boys club? Like, how has that been as far as you moving in from the music side to the movies? Have you been welcomed? Like, how's your transition going?
I think with regards to the higher end of the film industry, period, and that when I say higher end, it's only we're only really talking about commercials and movies, right? Mm-hmm. It's definitely old boys club. It's controlled by a particular type, right?
politically correct. I like that.
And you know, I'm not looking to be accepted, which is the reason why I'm just doing me. Creating my own opportunities, because I'd be old and grey still making tea if I was trying to get into that side of things, looking for an opportunity. You know, so it's tough. It's tough, and that's why, you know, the movie that. Well, my first movie that I'm creating now is done, funded by, you know, myself and a partner of mine. So we're doing this ourselves. We're not looking for funding. That's always quite difficult, you know?
Yeah. I guess on the other end of it would be, obviously, you're trailblazing. So are you seeing, especially young people of color, are they following in your footsteps? Are you mentoring them? Do you see them now becoming the place for, you're becoming the place where they can actually develop their ideas and develop the production for some of the shows that they have?
Sure. Well, I mean, I'd like to hope that they're using me and my example to give them some faith that the doors that they're knocking on that aren't opening, there's still a way in, mm-hmm. you know? A lot of people have made a lot of contact with me, especially with a lot of my recent publications that have gone on internationally. A lot of people are contacting me, you know, young black males, to be as an example. And they're like, hey, man, like, I've received some messages like, dude, I was about to move into some really uncanny activities, you know?
Shout out to the X-Men.
Yeah. Uncanny, I like the X-Men,
you know,
out here.
You know, because they're like, this is not working for me.
Yeah.
And then they're like, but I've seen what you're doing. And I'm like, bro, like, you look like me. So I'm going to stick at this. And that just gives me so much joy, man. Like the amount of messages and people are cheering me on. And I, likewise, I'm just answering questions, man. Like I spend most of the time in my DMs and that's it's almost a bit painstaking because I can't get no work done because I'm constantly messaging people. But I want to do it because I feel I've put myself out here. So now if I'm going to be a beacon, I need to keep it going. So I'm always asking people about what they're doing and giving them advice, and people are asking me every type of question you could imagine, you know, and I'm doing my best to answer and be encouraging, you know. I don't want to feel like I'm not accessible. Do you see what I mean? There has to be a reason how that happens, within reason, but I'm trying to give advice and mentor within reason. At some stage, I'll do a mentoring program that needs to be coordinated properly because there is a lot of people that reach out. And it's overwhelming. So I'm in the process of constructing some type of mentoring program that might probably kick off at the end of the year. It needs to be a proper program. But for now, man, people hit me up in my DMs. I'm always there to give advice, to give opportunities if I can. Obviously, bearing in mind our industry in the film is quite a skilled sector. So you have to actually know what you're doing, unless you want to come and be a runner. And not everybody wants to do that, you know. I still think it's a good idea to do that, but some people, you know, egos,
right.
Pride, they're not on it. So not as many people are coming through my doors as I would have hoped, mm-hmm. you know? Yeah. So it's one of those things.
So you learned a lot on the fly, I'm assuming, as far as, you know, doing the music side, videos, and then, you know, having the cameras, and then the real estate. Is this all self-taught, or did you have a mentor? Like, how did you learn?
I didn't have a mentor.
So you just figured it out as you go?
I figured it out.
Like, this is a good idea. Let me just dive in to learn as much as I possibly can about this.
A lot of it is instincts. I would say a lot of people ask me, Ant, why you? Like, how did you become this person? How did you achieve so much? You're one human, one guy, a black guy, let's call it out, in a country that isn't designed for us to elevate. Mm-hmm. That's the facts. Let's just call a spade, right? But what I think separates me is consistency. Everybody has a good day let's say figuratively, right? A good day in the office. Everybody's on form. They wake up one day and they have a good day where they're motivated, they're buzzing, they're on it, they're constructive. But not many people can sustain that. And that's the difference, yeah? It's, for me to do what I do is not a chore. Some people, it's really painful for them. Dude, this is just wired into my head. So, like, I have to stop myself from working and thinking and strategizing and take time away, you know, as opposed to thinking, oh, I need to do this. I need to be here. I need to work out this deal. I got to work on that. That's not like that for me. It's just all that water. Do you see what I mean? So I have an advantage at the fact that I'm not working at trying to be consistent. It's just absolutely natural. And I think that's just the only difference. I'm made of flesh, blood. I'm not Einstein. My IQ is not crazy. I'm a bit sharp, yeah. I have great instincts, but I'm just like anybody else. But the consistency is the only difference that separates me.
Most people.
You know? I say that all the time. That's it. People ask me all the time, like, what's the number one thing I could do? And I say, for us, originality and consistency. Originality and consistency. That's the two biggest pillars that I always say all the time. Like, you have to be original, you have to be creative, but you have to be consistent. And consistency is probably the most underrated trait in business. People don't understand how difficult it is to be consistent. Mm-hmm. Like, just to do one thing every single day for 5 years. It's not easy.
Yeah.
It's not easy.
You said that, obviously, you're in a country that is not meant to have black males elevate.
Or black people,
period. Black people, period, like, in general, right? So I'm wondering, when you're making films and you're making, who is the audience, right? Are we specifically looking for black men and women, or are we trying to get an international feel to it? Because there's got to be a balance between, you know, making it as a worldwide piece and trying to have an authentic London, England feel to it, right? So how do you do that?
I can answer that question quite simply. I'm not trying to make black films. I'm trying to make good films, right? However, what I will champion, and I'll say this straight on camera, I will make sure that we have black cast representation, black crew representation, and that I don't close the doors on certain people that didn't know were open. Yeah, and that's the difference. You know, that's what I would do. Because, and definitely international films, for sure. I'm not trying to pigeonhole or make something London-centric at all. I want an international movies moving forward that are good movies, but I'm going to make sure that the doors that are closed on our people, and there's a lot of them, and I've been one of those guys. I was just hard enough to kick through the door. A lot of people aren't built that way, and they just become depressed, or they lower their self-esteem, or they keep us doing these little baby projects and keep us busy, you know, like worker bees, which is not it's not cool. So I'm just trying to make sure that I can have that through my platform. I can say, right, okay, let me give this black female lead the cast because she's the best person for the job. Let me give this black gaffer or this black art director. Like, that's something that we will do moving forward to just help be another avenue for these people to have their platform and for them to shine, get paid, continue their career, evolve.
Yeah. You know? That's interesting. I mean, there's certain shows that we watched growing up. I mean, they're global. So I'm wondering, like, what were those type of shows or maybe movies that inspired you coming up?
Do you know what? I like all types of films, you know. Like, I'm not really into, like, romantic comedies. Okay. Like, I like action films. If you talk about what I watched growing up, it's not really relevant to this, but remember those old Shaolin movies where the dubbing, the voiceover was just crazy?
The Wu-Tang
inspired. Yeah, like, man, I just love that. But that's, we're talking when I was a kid, you know? And obviously all the old Hollywood films, like, I'm an 80s baby. So I think it was your birthday, right?
Yeah.
I was on the 22nd. Oh, so I'm 2-2-2-2-2-2-2 this year. Come on.
Pisces.
Yeah, man.
We all Pisces. Yeah.
You're Pisces as well?
Thursday.
Okay. Yeah. Happy birthday.
Pisces game.
Yeah, man. I know. It's the Pisces couch. It's the Pisces couch over here.
Yeah, yeah.
So, all right. How do you see, like, what's your 10-year plan? Like, how do you see yourself in 5-10 years? Like, what would you like to accomplish, or how would you like to scale up?
Good question. Good question. I would just say more, man. More. Like, that's just been the mindset since the first property, the first company. Mm-hmm. You know, more. But healthy growth and just being inclusive and making sure that I understand that I feel like I have a responsibility now to help everybody, you know, come up and help people avoid mistakes that I had to make. Because remember, I didn't have a mentor, so I made a lot of mistakes. It's not all been smooth. Like, yeah, I'm at the top of a mountain smiling and waving, but it weren't just like that. There was this, right? And that's something that I don't talk about. And at one stage, one day I will probably go into more detail about what that was. Mm. But it's been up and down, man. So it's like, I want to be a person, an advocate for people that are struggling to achieve their goals, be a platform that people can learn from, and be inclusive in terms of the film industry. I'd like to help a lot more ethnic minorities in not having to go through a lot of the things I went through. You know, I had to do it myself. Mm. And we shouldn't have to be in an industry where the only way for you to get an opportunity is for you to do it yourself. Like, you should be in an industry that is a bit more of a fair playing field, where you can get an opportunity because you're great, not because you fit in or you look right. Do you understand? So I want to try to change that. In terms of property, man, I've got a goal. I want to get to 100 million portfolio. That's my number in my head.
So with the real estate, going back to real estate, is a scaling model to get bigger, like buildings next?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a scaling model. I complete on a deal in April for a ground zero project. So from complete scratch, knocking down an old warehouse and building a set of luxury apartments. So it will just be more of that, you know.
Where are you going to do that at?
Essex as well, but a bit closer to London.
Okay.
A bit closer to London.
How many apartments?
Oh, 20.
20?
Yeah.
Okay. What are you going to name the building?
Pardon?
What are you going to name the building?
Probably after one of my daughters.
Okay. Mm.
Real talk.
Yeah. That's for another one of our... You know DJ Envy? The Breakfast Club?
Not personally, but yeah.
Yeah, but you know who he is.
Yeah, of course.
So he's in real estate heavy, and his partner, Caesar... So they developed like a big project, and that's he named it after his daughter.
Oh wow, it's amazing, man.
Yeah,
that's.
So on the developmental side for real estate, what's the process for that out here? Is it like a little bit harder, or is it kind of similar to how? Well, you probably don't even know how it is in the States, but like, yeah, what's the process to actually develop a apartment building from scratch?
Well, the good thing is regarding. Qualifying for property, the qualification has no skin tone, right? That's the good news. Your accounts are your accounts. That's what anybody cares about. Mm-hmm. What's your P&L saying? What's your balance sheet saying? And that's basically that. In terms of being real estate, anybody can do real estate, but unfortunately, you kind of need capital if you want to be doing development. And you will not get finance unless you have an element of money anyway, or you have businesses where your accounts can cash flow what's called stress testing, you know, to make sure that if no revenue is generated in that property, can you maintain it? Can you maintain the service, the debt level? Mm-hmm. So it is not the sort of thing you can do from stage one, you know, but anybody that's just getting into the game, you know, 20, 30, 40 grand, you can start small and flip. You won't be able to refinance on that type of deal and get your money back because there's not enough money in it to get back.
Yeah.
But you can still do flips. Make a 10, a 12, a 15. You could do that, you know.
What are some good areas you can invest in the greater London area? Because I know London is probably saturated.
I think any area is a good area because it's what you pay for the property, right? If I got a £20 million three-story property in Hyde Park, but I can buy it for £17 million and it's going to cost me $1 million to refurb, then I'm going to buy it, refurb it, flip it. I can't remortgage that because I'm not going to, well, I can, but I'm not going to get my money back. I'll just flip that and make a $2 million, mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
So that's how I would do that. What I would say is in terms of areas, to be more technical, areas that are on the up in terms of their the capital growth potential, most of the areas in London are done already. Edmonton is in North London, I've got property there. That's a very, very good location because if you've got an area that's really, really cheap, but the areas right next to it is a lot more expensive, then you have a thing in property called the ripple effect. Mm. And it's just a matter of years. And this is without the regeneration process as well, regeneration potential. When I say that, I mean when the local borough council say we're going to put in 50 million regeneration into this area. Take that to one side because that's another way. If you can find out what areas have regeneration, good area to buy. But just from the ripple effect alone, like Tottenham, for example, used to be pretty run down. You know, it was known like Brixton. Mm. But now Tottenham is kind of being gentrified as well. Mm. They're building apartments everywhere that they can fit space. And the prices have gone, for example, a 3-bedroom house in Tottenham 10 years ago would have cost you maybe 200 grand, 200,000 pounds, 250 maybe, 10 years ago, right? Maybe 300 at a push. Now you're looking at 600, 650. That's crazy return, you know? And Edmonton is probably 5 years away from that. So I'm buying more in that area because it's the ripple. You had Highbury in Islington, then you had Tottenham. That was the ripple. And then next is Edmonton.
Yeah.
Are you with me? Then after that, it's Enfield and it goes out. But there's not many areas left. But I would say what you should do, again, a bit of advice to people, there's a website called Rightmove that is our national website for property. You want to see a property value, go to Rightmove.
Rightmove?
Rightmove, yeah. And then you go onto that and it tells you all the properties that are for sale in the country. It has to be on that website. And type in a bracket, say for example, 300,000, 3-bedroom house, and then put your parameter as London. See what's for sale, look at those areas. If there's only a couple of properties, that means that you know that's your barrier to entry for that price. So you wanna get the property for as low to that number as possible. So in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, that 300 grand property is gonna be worth 350. Sell the property. Make your 50,000 profit. Get your other deposit back. Now you're in the game. It's not that hard. Obviously, there's levels to this, but it's not that hard. But even the entry level, it's not difficult.
Yeah, that's a fact.
So, I mean, that's extensive in the real estate side for a goal. I want to talk about the production side. Like, what's the goal? Because obviously, films is something that you're doing now, but as you make bigger films, the budgets get bigger.
Absolutely.
And so, I want to talk about how we're going to finance that, but also maybe from getting shows that are put on TV, sitcoms and licensing deals and syndication, like are all these things in the plans for you?
Absolutely. So I'm currently making my first movie at the moment, which is a psychological thriller called Forgive Me, Father.
Forgive Me, Father?
Forgive Me, Father, yeah.
Psychological thriller.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I would say it's a psychological thriller slash movie. So I would say it's like Saw meets Seven.
Seven is one of my favorite movies.
Bro, that's a film.
Oh my God.
The twist, right?
Seven. Yeah, Seven.
That's a psychological.
Right. Yeah. So obviously, like, not trying to.
So it's like dark.
Trying to set the bar.
Yeah. I'm like, you make it Seven.
That's the aim.
It's like a dark.
Super dark, yeah. So that's currently in production. As we speak, we're on set. We're in week 3 of a 4-week schedule. And we go to post next month. Or probably the beginning of April. And that's my first film, you know? And part of that movie has been shot at my new country location, you know? So that's quite special because I've christened that location as, for the first movie, one of many that will be shot in that area, that location, my movie is the first one.
With the concept.
Bro, so like that's quite special on a sentimental level, you know? That's quite special.
So as far as the production, are you looking for, like, what's the process? Somebody writes a script.
Correct.
Then they bring it to you.
Yeah. We'd purchase the script.
You buy the script.
We'll buy the script so we can own the IP.
So you own the IP.
Absolutely.
You have to own the IP.
For me, for my model, yeah. I'm only dealing with ownership.
There's only one way this is getting done.
I only deal with ownership.
So you buy it and then you hire a director.
Correct.
And then, of course, the actors and whatever.
Yeah,
and then you just put the vision. So,
put it together. I'll exec produce / produce the movie. So
I oversee the situation.
Absolutely.
But you're not like hands-on actually directing it. You don't tell the director. You let the director do his thing.
Of course.
You just kind of give him something.
Yeah. But what I will do from a kind of overseeing eye is look at that budget, make sure it's realistic. So I use my film experience. Is this realistic? What can I bring to the table? What value can I add? What lines can I bring in? And just make sure everybody's happy from afar and know that our exit is in place, you know? So just what executive producers do, really.
There you have it. This is dope. We definitely got to do something there, man, for sure.
Yeah, I know two guys, if you ever need, like, two leads in a movie.
Are they Pisces, yeah?
Yeah, they're Pisces. That helps.
Nah. This is a good one, man. So what would you say, parting words, like, What would you say to the young boy that's in East London or Brixton that has an idea, has a vision, but you know, still trying to put it together, hasn't really figured it out yet. Like, what would your advice be to them based on the stuff that the ups and downs, trials and tribulations that you went through?
I would say keep experimenting, because just because you don't know what you want to do isn't a bad thing. Because sometimes when you know what you don't want to do, that's also progress. Are you with me?
Mm-hmm.
So you can be doing something and thinking, ah, oh, this wasn't for me. That was terrible. I don't know what I want to do. Well, okay, you don't know what you want to do, but you know you don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So you're closer to finding what you do want to do. So just staying with it and having faith and knowing that, you know, if you put out good energy 9 times out of 10, yeah, good things will happen. Just be humble, be hardworking, and have integrity, you know, because losing yourself is something that can happen very easily when you're chasing money or your dreams. And just staying true to yourself and believing in yourself, because people will not always open the door for you. So it doesn't mean that you have no value. Yeah? So believe in yourself. That's where the value comes from.
Let me ask you this too before we leave. We see a lot of UK actors, black UK actors. Of course, Idris Elba is probably the most famous one, but there's a lot of them that have gone to America and become like really big stars in America, in Hollywood. Do you have your eyes set on Hollywood at all? Like, do you ever see yourself actually going to America and being in the Hollywood world?
Not particularly, because it's different for actors. I'm behind the screen. I'm providing huge facilities. So a lot of American movies are shot here. So as far as I'm concerned, I'm waiting for Hollywood to come to me.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Yeah. You know? I like that.
Come knock on the door.
I like that.
Come check your neighbor out.
Like and that. Tyler as well.
I hope you Tyler, heard that, Tyler.
The link up. Would you ever be? I know you said you your motto is own everything, but are you open to partnerships?
Absolutely. If the value add is there, if the partner adds value that I can't add, then it's a match made in heaven for sure. You know, so the right collaboration, of course.
Yeah. So we could see like Madea takes London.
Pardon?
Madea takes London.
Yeah, maybe.
this was a good one, man. I appreciate it. What would be your last words? How can the people follow you? I guess social media, website, any new project? You talk about the movie, any other new projects that you have, anything that you want to make the people aware of?
Listen, man, like, as I said, we're open to all the companies are open to all. You can find Sydney House, East London Studios, Mastermind Media, our socials, we'll link you up with that. People can follow me on Instagram, really. That's the best.
What's your Instagram handle?
It's Antoine Dixon Bellot. No hyphen. Okay. So Antoine Dixon Bellot. Just that's it.
All one word.
All one word. No hyphen.
And people, if they want to like actually rent the facility, all the information is like on the website.
Absolutely.
What's the website?
Everything's there. We've got cine-house.com for the rental company. We've got East London Studios, all one word, .com. For the film studio and CineScope Optics for the lens manufacturing company.
Oh. Troy, housekeeping items?
Yeah, Anton, this won't be the last time we see each other.
Oh, I hope not, man.
I'm pretty sure. I want to thank you again. I want to thank our Tape London family for the hospitality.
Oh, yeah, shout out to Tape London.
It's been an amazing time here in London. So shout out to y'all. Shout out to all the UK earners. Shout out to all the earners worldwide. We greatly appreciate y'all. Every time we go somewhere, it feels like home. So I know that has a lot to do with y'all. So shout out to y'all. Shout out to everybody that's supporting the merch. Shout out to the team. We got the team here in London with us. Mike, obviously, Bam, Jamal, Yogi's here with us. And B's here behind the scenes shooting content for us. So shout out to everybody that made this a special one. And shout out to my boy's birthday yesterday, man. We went up again. This has been a legendary party. I don't think I've been out this much in my life.
London is definitely a party town. But once again, thank you to Ashley for actually making this connection. And super dope. I'm glad we got a chance to shoot content while we were out here, because I think it's important for voices from all over the world to be heard. Because it's like we have a strong following in the UK, but we just don't want to just have American-based content that they have to just listen to. Mm-hmm. We want to have, you know, UK-based content as well. And the same with when we go to Nigeria or Jamaica or different parts of the world. So that's why every time we travel, we always try to, you know, connect. And just, you know, the power of relationships is extremely important. And I feel like we just have to do more of that. Cross-continental collaboration, and you know, we have a lot more similarities than we have differences. And I feel like, you know, hopefully this will be an education for people in America as well that might not be fully educated or fully, you know, aware of what's going on in the UK. I think everybody is like drinking tea and crumpets.
That's what I was about to say.
right.
Yeah, they think everybody drinking tea and crumpets, and you know, it's just come from a lack of education, like, no. So now hopefully, you know, they can start to see, like, okay, yeah, they just like me. just with a little different accent.
Yeah, for sure.
They say Q instead of line. Nah, but I appreciate it, brother. Man, anything that we can do to help, you know, further, you know.
Guys, honestly, it's been an absolute pleasure, man. Thank you. Super honor. Love what you guys are doing. It's super amazing as well.
Thank you.
And your platform's crazy. So happy to be here.
Thank you, brother. Thank you, brother. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that is a wrap. We will see you next week. Peace.
Peace.
My graduates from my school being Forbes. Bag drop.
Bag drop.
A mic drop. Bag drop.
Bag drop.